Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is studio designer John Brandt. First of all, we keep on hearing about online concerts, and there are some artists that are fairly successful at it, except they usually don't get paid for it. Well, some artists do, though. BTS, the K-pop boy band, just had something called Bang Bang Con, and in it they had 756,000 concurrent paying customers from 107 different regions around the world. It's pretty amazing. Equivalent to 15 sold-out shows at 15,000 capacity stadiums. So basically they made more than $20 million from this 100-minute long show. They did 12 songs, and it was across 5 rooms and 2 stages. I think the cool thing is the viewers got a chance to watch this from any of 6 different screen angles. So in fact, they saw 6 screens. They can pick the one they wanted whenever they wanted. And that was kind of an added extra. And especially in something here where it's kind of static, this is the perfect interactive tool for an online concert. Now, there are a lot of artists that are out there doing live streams, and some, again, are really successful, and some have numbers that are somewhat similar, except they're not getting paid for it. So this is pretty amazing. It shows it can be done. I'm not so sure how many can do the same thing, but that being said, it is possible. You just have to have a huge following like BTS. Now, taking that in a different direction, Garth Brooks is about to do a drive-in tour. So in other words, he's going to do a concert, and it's going to be broadcast to 300 drive-ins across the country. He's charging $100 per car or truck, and they sold 50,000 tickets within the first 2 hours. So this is coming up later in a month. It should be interesting to see how that works. I think in theory it's really cool. The only problem is you're listening to inferior audio at the normal drive-in. So I'm not so sure how this would be received, but good for Garth Brooks for trying something different. So as we can see, there's a lot of things that are happening. Superstars are making money. Doesn't mean it's going to trickle down to everybody, though. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. You can also sign up for my free vocal mixing techniques mini course at bobbyosinskicourses.com and download free ebooks and PDFs on mixing, production, mastering, and social media at bobbyosinski.com/free-resources. I was reading an article the other day on Music Radar. It was by Scott Solita, and it was about the things that he didn't miss about studios. And I was reading it, and certainly I took it to heart because I felt pretty much exactly the same way. The first thing was cables. Take notice, in your home studio, you don't have many cables, at least compared to what we used to have in a particular studio. Now, I have a whole garage full of cables from my last studio, and I don't think I'm ever going to use them. I really don't want to get rid of them. The connectors are worth some money in themselves, but that being said, there's some cables out there that will probably never be used again. And this is something we don't have to deal with so much in the modern studio. Now, of course, it's different in a commercial studio, but we're talking about the typical studio that the average engineer or producer used to have. The other thing that we don't have to deal with and don't miss is noise. Now, again, once we're inside the box, it's a noiseless environment. And for those of you who never grew up in a real studio, one of the problems is there was always some noise gremlin for every session that occurred. Yeah, you'd have these mysterious noises that would come and go. You'd plug in a new piece of gear, and of course, there'd be a noise. You have to try to ground lift everything to get rid of it, and there was always a noise that you were chasing, and of course, we don't have that anymore. Noises from patch bays used to drive me crazy because patch bays, in fact, do get dirty, and you have to exercise them. Same with consoles, faders, switches. If you had channels that you didn't use, they get dirty and noisy. So in the box, we don't have to deal with that. Another thing is crawling behind racks. So you probably don't have a rack, or if you do, it's a very simple one in your studio. Unlike the racks that we used to have of all sorts of gear, and we'd have rack upon rack upon rack. And inevitably, you'd be crawling behind it with a flashlight, once a session at least, trying to interconnect something, or trying to chase down a noise, or trying to figure out why something wasn't working. Don't miss that at all. No headroom. Well, that was a problem in many cases, especially when we were trying to mix semi-pro with pro gear. Pro gear, usually there's plenty of headroom, but you tried to mix some of the other devices that became popular that were semi-pro, so to speak, and then you had all these headroom problems, and of course, we don't have any of that, if you know how to do it, in the box these days. Tuning issues. Well, you still have to tune your guitars, you still have to tune your instruments, but the fact of the matter is, when it comes to synthesizers, we don't have any of those problems that we used to have. Oscillator drift used to be a major pain in the butt. So you would have your synth perfectly in tune, and next thing you know, an oscillator would drift and it would be out of tune. You'd have to go tune it up, and this would happen multiple times over the course of a session. We don't have to deal with that anymore, thank God. Maintenance. One of the things you don't realize about having a big studio is it requires maintenance. And that's on a regular basis because there's always something that needs to be fixed, especially when we're talking the analog domain. Digital domain is much more forgiving, but in the analog domain, there was always something that was failing, and when it fails, it costs you money. For those of us who lived through the tape days, I don't know how many of you actually look back with nostalgia on it. There was a lot of hassle, not to mention the costs involved, and just the hassles of playing around with tape were not that much fun. And again, it's easy now to look back, especially if you've never done it, and look back with some fondness and say, oh boy, I wish we went through that. Well, no, it's better now without it, believe me. Another thing you don't realize is the costs of owning a studio, especially one with the big console. Just the electricity and the air conditioning costs alone were enormous. One of the reasons why is big desks use a lot of power and they give off a lot of heat. You're paying for the power and all that heat, you have to cool down somehow, so you're running air conditioning 24/7. Just the cost of that alone is too big a nut for many studios to even bother with these days. And finally, the limitations of analog. We don't have that anymore. If you need another track, it's really easy to dial up. If you need another 10 tracks, really easy to dial up. If you need another effects processor, well, no problem. Another reverb, no problem. Back in the day, we had limitations in all those because you only had so many reverbs, so many delays, so many limiters, so many processors. And if you go back to analog, we only had so many tracks. So today, it's so much better in so many ways. When I look back in those analog days, I'm glad I went through it. But the fact of the matter is, it's a whole lot better today than it's ever been. So appreciate what you have because it's very cool. My guest this week is John Brandt, who's owned studios and built custom audio equipment in both the UK and Nashville before delving deeper into the world of studio design. John's company, J.H. Brandt Acoustic Designs, now provides design and consulting services to music studios, commercial video and cinema facilities, home recording studios, home theaters, presentation and conference rooms, performance and entertainment spaces, educational facilities, and industrial acoustic applications all over the world. John also freely shares advice on most of the popular online audio forums and has numerous helpful articles on his website. During the interview, we talked about how much the science of acoustics has changed, his approach to different types of design jobs, the pros and cons of mass-loaded vinyl, the latest in acoustic treatment, and much more. John also took me through a model of the ideal studio design, which is a real eye-opener. I spoke to John via Zoom from his home just outside of Jakarta, Indonesia. Let's start from the beginning, though, because I know you have a very interesting background. So let's go back to the beginning and tell me how you started in the business.
Well, I started out, I really kicked it off when I started working as a roadie for Jeremy Spencer in Europe. Mm-hmm. I was his guitar roadie. And that was in, when was that? 74. That's when it really kicked off. I graduated high school in 1971. Mm-hmm. And I left high school. I was going to go to college and study music. Okay. But a band happened.
Yeah. So, funny how that works.
You know, and I ended up in Chicago and then what was it, Ann Arbor, and then to Boston, and I started getting good at, you know, doing some mixing and stuff and working with, you know, helping the band with the gear, and I knew what I was doing, or so they thought at the time. I didn't know what the heck I was doing.
As long as they're happy.
Yeah. Well, so I got a call to go to Europe to help this new band they were being put together for some, like, the Guy Lux show in Paris. And here I meet Jeremy. And so I worked with him for, gosh, I guess it was about eight months or so, maybe longer. I don't remember. It's really fuzzy back then.
Yeah.
And I toured Europe with several other bands and did a bunch of stuff and ended up in England. Married an English girl and I had two kids, and one is now, my son is a live sound engineer and does very well in LA. He works in LA. Mm-hmm. And my daughter is in London. She's an actress.
Okay. So how did that take you into getting your studio design chops together?
Ah, man, lots of tries. I think my first studio design was was back in 90, what was it, 90, 91. Really? I mean, this is the really try to studio design in 91. I worked with Byron Gallimore at Pride Music Group then, and turned in, he bought Charlie's place out and turned it into Song Garden, something like that.
I remember that, yeah.
And then, so I helped him with that, and it's not very good. And then I got the idea of, well, you know what? There's a roadmap to all this. And I'm sticking with my technical stuff, always technical, always, you know, installing consoles and modifying them and electronics and stuff. And that's how I know Bill Whitlock. And his papers and stuff. I don't know him well. He's not like a buddy friend of mine, no, but we've spoken and had, you know, sent emails back and forth, and I share some of my designs with him and stuff. But and that's where I got his 2010 paper on the AES ground loops, The Rest of the Story, which is talking about the twisted live and neutral in studios.
Yeah.
Running the live and the neutral twisted with the ground straight. And it's solving so many problems. And still today, studio designers don't understand this, and they're just wiring it like the old thing and running the electrical up here and the audio down here and making huge loops.
Yeah, right.
And I worked with Neil Muncy in 98, who taught me about the zero loop area concept. It was fantastic, and it just changed my whole world. It was great. So, and it been incorporating that into studio design since. Mm-hmm. Like I said in some posts on Facebook and in other blogs, that don't try to design this stuff yourself. I mean, some people get lucky. Yeah. Some people get lucky. I mean, what's his name that did Power Station, the producer?
Oh, Tony Bongiovi.
Oh, yeah, yep. Tony Bongiovi. I think he got lucky, really, honestly.
Yeah.
It was really good. It was very fortunate. And, but few do. Few really get lucky, you know. And this is why I say, since 1979 was the year that LEDE, RFZ criteria was published.
Yeah.
That was over 40 years ago.
Yeah.
If you look at 40 years ago in medical research, where were we? In cancer research, in particle accelerator research, where were we 40 years ago? We were light years behind back there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Long time. And in the field of acoustics, a lot of research is going on. A lot of people are researching and coming up with new stuff and papers are being published daily. And, you know, I try to keep an eye on them. I got my head down most of the time and they go over my, you know, I miss them. But ever so often, I'll read that. And some very interesting stuff and some really good insights have come out. I know that both Hidley's and Newell's non-environment designs were cutting edge at the time. They were really, really very good, but the problem with them is they're not good for human beings.
Yeah. Right.
Because humans don't like sitting in an anechoic chamber. Even though you've got a reflective front wall and a floor, it's still anechoic everywhere else, and it can be disconcerting. And our primitive part of our brain wants to fight or flight, you know?
Yeah.
And it stresses us out, and we don't know what that is, but we go, gosh, I'm fatigued, man. This is, I got to go out and get a cigarette or a cup of coffee or some fresh air, something.
Yeah.
You know? And so what you have to solve that problem with reflections, but you got to keep those reflections way below this Haas trigger thing.
Right.
And they talk about that with the LEDE concept, RFC. You need to have it in the Haas trigger. No, you don't. If you do, you're going to notice it, and you're going to adjust according to what you hear. So, and here I get into the meat of why we wanted to meet.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is the capricious quality of the LEDE or RFC concept. It's capricious because you go to one well-built, well-made LEDE or RFC room, same criteria, just flip.
Yeah.
You go into a well-made room, you sit down to work, you go, oh, okay, wait, let me play my reference material and get my head around this. Okay. Oh, I see. And walk around the room. Okay. Okay. And then you sit down, you can work after a day of acclimating yourself to that situation. Okay. Now, if you're really good, like Eddie Kramer goes in and he listens and okay, got this. And he gets to work and he nails it every time. I mean, this guy's unbelievable. Anyway. So you get your head around it and you get to work and you do a good job. Then the next day or next week, you go to another studio, similar concept design. You sit down. Oh, this is really so messed up. And you have to recalibrate yourself again. In other words, as Tom Hidley always said, when you are sitting in a control room, when you're trying to design a control room, you want the truth. That's all you want to get is the truth. You want accuracy. But if you have reflections that are causing comb filtering and all other phase issues, it's not working, is it? You might as well just stay home and use your headphones.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you might as well just, you know, I don't know. Don't spend all that money. It's not worth it.
Now, see, I think we're coming from different places here. I know we're coming from different places. Yeah. When I recommend that somebody does an RFC, it's always because they have a home studio. There's nothing else. They have nothing in their room. And it's just a cheap and easy way for them to get something that's better than they had. So I never recommend that they build their studio around that concept. It's like, okay, you have nothing now. This is going to make it a little better.
Correct.
Just so you understand.
Absolutely. No, I do understand. I really, really do. And, you know, I have conversations with new people all the time, every day, a couple of them. We have interviews like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, as Clint Eastwood said in Dirty Harry, he said, man's got to know his limitations.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
And if you know your limitations, then you can work with that. You know, I got a small bedroom. I want to make it usable. Okay, do this, RFZ. That will fix it enough to get you started. And it'll teach you about tuning your head. That's good. It's all good. But then when you go about to spend money to build from the ground up, or you rent or buy a warehouse and you build a studio, and then don't do the damn RFZ concept. What's wrong with you? Here, I got a new pistol. I'm going to shoot myself in the foot. You know?
Yeah.
Forgive me. I speak fluent French, you know. I'm not talking about French from France. I'm talking about French as in American slang. Okay. I want to say these words sometimes because it's the only words that define this so clearly, but I don't know if I can on your podcast. Anyway,
Okay, let me ask you a question. So you've been doing this for a long time, and obviously there's a certain amount of trial and error, even if you're guided by some wonderful mentors, which you were. When did you get to the point where you went, ah, I think I have this now?
Oh, that's every year. Every year. The next year I go, oh, shoot, what was I thinking? Oh, man, that's so messed up.
Yeah.
If you're really looking for excellence and you're trying to do better, that's how it will be. In an engineering career, in a mastering career, in a production career, it's always that way.
Yeah, but at a certain point you go, okay, I think I have this figured out enough that I know I'm going to give the client something that they're going to love, rather than when you first started anything, it's like, I hope they like this, rather than you get to a point and you go, I know they're going to like this.
Well, honestly, frankly, just to be brutally honest with you, and people go, what? Only that long ago? 5 years. 5 years ago.
Hmm.
Prior to 5 years, I could definitely improve on those designs.
Yeah.
Prior to actually 2 years ago, I can improve on those designs. The math is all there, but there are some things, you know, a lot of times you can figure, you use your roadmap, you use your criteria, you do all your numbers and everything. There are things that will come up and get you that you didn't even think about. You know, if you know, the old philosophical trick of, well, what if you don't know that you don't know something?
Yeah.
How do you know if, you know, it's like that. So eventually you'll figure it out, because one of your clients will go, hey, John, this it's not working, or why is this always, you know? And you go, well, wait a minute, let me run the number. Oh, wait, did I miss this thing? Whatever it was, you know?
Yeah.
And so you go and you figure again.
I looked at your website a lot yesterday, and one thing kind of jumped out at me, and I understand you're outside of Jakarta, so you're far, far away from most of your clients. So you can't do on-site research at all. It must be very difficult to do this from afar, because I know there are so many different things that you learn when you go on site and you actually look at everything. You go, oh, you didn't tell me about that. Oh, wait a second. Oh, you didn't even know that was happening there. So how do you reconcile that?
I reconcile it with, a requirement with my clients that we have very good communication, and we do this daily. You know, with all my clients, we have scheduled and we go through things. I've got a client in Australia right now that I designed the project 3 years ago. He really hasn't done it yet, and he's just starting it. So I'm going to update his design and work through him. And what I do, we do a video walkthrough, and I say, wait, what's that? Show me that corner again. Okay. What'd you do there? You know, I need to know, and I can find out. And the thing is, when you could do it too. You're experienced at hearing places and hearing the sound. And you know, when you see a place, you go, oh, I know what that sounds like.
Yeah.
You kind of do, you know, you have to have that experience in order, if you want to try to do what I do, you kind of have to have that experience behind you. You know what these things sound like. And it's funny, I'm old and I've got tinnitus in both ears from too much rock and roll. And my wife and son are doing something. And I said, don't you hear that? Is there somebody out? I said, what? Where? I don't hear it. And it's because of ear training, I guess. But I notice things, you know, that they don't. It's funny. And they're younger, much younger than me.
I'm curious. You're an American. You grew up in the United States. How did you get to Malaysia?
Indonesia.
Yeah.
Jakarta, Indonesia. I met my wife 12 years ago. Come here talking about a job here, a project, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And met her at a hotel. She was working. We had discussion. We just hit it off, and bam, we started writing to each other. After I went back 8 months later, I was back here, and I never left.
Got it.
We've been married 11 years now.
Yeah,
and we've got a 10-year-old daughter. So there you go.
Yeah.
This is wonderful. I owe everything to her. Really, I do.
I love that part of the world. I haven't been in Indonesia, but I recently went to Malaysia and Singapore and all through there, and it was really fascinating. I loved it a lot.
It's fascinating, all right. There's some pros and cons. The pros are, believe it or not, they say that freedom is not so high on the list over here. Well, actually, it kind of is, because there's no police state here. They're afraid of people, which is good. And that, you have a little more personal freedom. You got the sea, and you got the tropical climate, and it's just gorgeous. And the people are kind and polite, even though they're not that way behind your back, but at least to your face, they are.
What you don't know won't hurt you, so it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as long as you don't get in a dark alley without proper, you have to. The thing is, I learned here, and this is all way off our audio subject, but if you go traveling anywhere in the world, as an American, you have to remember, you're not protected by nanny state anymore.
Yeah.
You have to be responsible. You are responsible for your actions and your choices. You go into a bad area, you might die. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's not their fault. It's not the country's fault. It's your fault. You have to use your head. You have to be smart. Be responsible. Anyway.
Okay. So I know you do a lot of different type of jobs, and I'm curious, is your approach the same, generally the same to the mall? I mean, the difference between doing a commercial studio and a home theater and maybe a video post place, would your general approach be the same?
It's really similar. Very, very much the same. Okay. Number one, soundproofing. The first thing I ask my clients are, how much soundproofing do you need? Because soundproofing is just keeping noise out and keeping your noise in.
Right.
And we need a number for that, a standardized number. And so sometimes I'll have them do some testing, or hire a local person to come in there and do a sweep of field transmission loss, FTL testing, or they can do it with REW. You can do it if you know the procedure. So I talk them through it. I charge extra for this, but I talk them through the procedure and run the sweeps, and then send me the data, and I'll do the ASTM, the STC curve and charts for them.
Yeah.
And so that's number one. You assess your situation. You find out what your noise criteria is in the area, and then we meet or exceed that. That's number one. No matter if it's a home studio or a professional facility, because you don't want to be bothering your neighbor. If you're doing a bedroom studio, like if you're upstairs, you can do a mix room, but you can't do a little tracking room upstairs unless you float the floor. And if you float the floor on U-boats, it's not going to work. You might as well just put down some Regupol, which is an impact flooring, and that's it. It doesn't float your floor. I'm sorry, I'm getting off track. In isolation, and then you have your ventilation. Now, once you get it isolated and sealed, you got a sealed room, you close that door, it's airtight.
You have to exchange the air, or else people will fall over.
Absolutely. The requirement is, this is a standardized requirement, 15 cubic feet per minute per person, or half a cubic meter per minute per person, wherever you are, whatever system works best for you. But you've got to have that. If you go in and close that door and you don't have ventilation, it's like the Wicked Witch of the West with Dorothy up in the tower, and she turns the hourglass over and says, "See that? That's how long you've got to be alive." It's not long, my pretty. So, you have to have fresh air. And I've heard that oxygen is really required for creativity. It's also required for life.
Yeah. Okay, why are you talking about isolation? It seems to be such a brute force system to overcome that. I mean, really, what we're talking about is mass to overcome it. Now,
number one is mass. Yes.
Okay, number one is mass. I see things here and there about new materials that are in making that easier rather than going through cinder block walls and whatever, or 3 layers of gypsum board or whatever. What have you seen that, or used for that matter, that helps improve that in a more modern way?
Okay. Green glue can help. It's a CLDM, constrained layer damping material. And now there are some other CLDMs that are available. There's one here of what's it called? Something 30. Anyway, it's a mixed thing in a bucket and you trowel it on. Similar stuff. Same thing they use on aircraft. You know, they sandwich the aluminum panels together and it really attenuates the sound. That's good stuff. Sometimes, though, it's not worth it. Depends on your situation. You have to, you know, add up all the factors. And usually, honestly, I still go with standard building materials. I haven't found anything, any magic product to solve the problem. The best thing to use is fire-rated gypsum board. Get the heaviest, densest stuff you can find. Now, heavy and dense, that's per thickness, okay?
Yeah.
If you get it, well, this is heavier and denser. It's 2 inches thick. Well, how are you going to put it up?
Yeah.
Just get the regular fire-rated stuff and stack it to the thickness that's required without any air gaps. Now, that's a mass. And then you have seal. You have to seal your all around the perimeter with a flexible caulk so, you know, it doesn't break open because buildings move. They move every day. The sun comes up, they grow. The sun goes down, they shrink. And everything shrinks and expands at different rates. And so things are going to open up if you don't do it right. Anyway, that's the mass approach. Then you have the mass air mass approach, which is a spring function. It's a resonance function. And you can multiply your sound transmission loss incredibly by using that approach. Usually requires a lot more space.
Yeah, that's the downside.
That is a downside. It's just one of those things, though. It is physics.
That's been used for years. That concept has been used for forever almost in recording studios.
They found that it works. And, you know, like the old man said, if it's not broke, don't fix it. But I have a little Facebook booth group, you know, voiceover artists and booths. I'm just trying to help people with doing their voiceovers and stuff and reading books and whatnot. It's just a little tiny thing. See, it's a different approach than studios, really. And right here, I mean, I don't know if you can see it. I got this panel here that helps my mic sound better in my concrete office room. I've got panels behind me. See those fancy pattern there? Those are panels that I just stuck up in the corner. Now, those are panels, which I don't normally do in studios. This is for voiceover. It's for conference rooms and different things like that. That's what these are for. And they work fine for that. It's for voice frequencies from 125 to 4K. Now, I really got off the subject there. My little voice group, I've had a lot of posts talking about, well, I put Automute on this side and then I put gypsum board and stuff. I said, you know, if you use your MLV and then you put gypsum board on it or drywall on it, you've defeated the purpose. You might as well have used just an eighth inch drywall there instead of the MLV, because it kills it. It kills it dead. If it's limp, it works wonders. It works great. And the application for mass loaded vinyl and that sort of thing is in curtains or big blankets like they sell from, who is it? Kinetics. Kinetics sell these blankets for industrial use. They have grommets on the top. You hook them around your machinery that's on the warehouse floor, making all this noise to quieten it down. And it does a great job.
Mm-hmm.
But for studios, no. I've used MLV in mobile rigs, okay? Taking a mobile caravan and turning it into a little studio. Where the steel or aluminum sides come in and they're ribbed and they have ribs going around and you can attach the MLV to the rib and then add ribs to that, build it out. And so the MLV is left limp and then you've got your panels inside there and it does a great job with this much space, you know, to do your soundproofing in. And you can't put gypsum board in there because you hit a bump and everything cracks and falls.
Yeah,
you
know? Right.
Yeah. So it's one of those things.
So we talked about isolation and your thoughts and approach. Let's talk about the inside of a studio, forgetting about the soundproofing. Let's just talk about acoustic treatment for a second. So I know that's evolved over the years, and the whole concept of how you treat everything has evolved quite a lot. What is the state of the art now?
State of the art are two ways. One is multiple layers, which is what I use, or membranic a system like Thomas Jongjinda uses, Northwood Acoustics. I will go with the easier to build stuff as much as possible, because I don't like seeing my money, my clients losing money or going in the hole to build this thing. And you can build a $1 million studio that only costs you, $50,000. You can do it. It just has to be done right. And you can use some cheaper materials as long as you don't skimp on the ones that count. I use different densities of materials for the absorption. And I use air. I use lightweight fiber. I use Dacron, which is a very low GFR. Mm-hmm. And then I use a little bit of rigid rock wool or glass or rigid, fiberglass like the 703 stuff. But I only use it in 1-inch pieces, not 2-inch. I use it more like a panel. And the only 2-inch pieces I use is smack dab on the at the pressure zone on the wall, right in that boundary zone. So that's where it really, really shines. It really works well. But I don't use rock wool or rigid fiberglass as a rule for treatment. It's a boundary thing. I should show you one of my latest designs here. I'll pull this up. Here's I've got two versions. One is a hard flush mount and the other is a soft flush mount. Most of my builds incorporate a soft flush mounting of the speakers.
Mm, yeah.
They work very well. The only problem with any kind of flush mounting is floor bounce. You're still going to get that. And it usually exhibits itself as a dip right there between 100 and 200 or somewhere around there. And it's frustrating as heck. And I think I've solved the problem by revisiting some of Tom Hidley's stuff.
So the thought there, what I've always felt is that you actually need that to some degree, because it gives you a sense of realism in the room. And if you deaden that too much, then in fact, it sounds unnatural. Floor bounce is something that we're used to.
Well, true. This is true. But when you're listening to a source, you want to hear it just clean and clear without that.
Well, you don't want a resonant frequency or anything. Yeah.
Right. We want to get rid of the phase cancellation, but we want the floor, because the reflective floor keeps that RT60 up. So it maintains a level of realness. That, I think, is what you mean.
Yes, right.
You go into a carpeted control room and it's so good, you lose a lot of that top end and you lose that sense of it. And there's a lot of things that I do in rooms to keep the top end in the room longer without affecting your mix decisions. It's just, it's there, but it's not noticeable, but you would definitely notice it if it weren't there. May I share my screen?
Yes, please. Yes.
Okay. This is a wireframe view of one of my latest designs. I'm going to go into conceptual here and rotate a little bit and remove some layers. I'll take the ceiling off first. Now I'm going to remove the top, which is a concrete box. Now this is ideal. This is like, well, if you could do what you wanted, this is the way to do it.
Yeah.
These are our TGI joists. This is, ceiling gypsum board. These are waveguides above the drop ceiling. Okay.
Interesting.
Go around it here. They are all, each one of them is pointing at the woofer of the speakers.
Hmm.
Okay, when a speaker reproduces, it produces a sphere of energy that goes out omnidirectionally, flows out from it like a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And so this will take that bubble and shift it and bounce it towards the ceiling and run it through the fiber many more times than it would ordinarily. Now, above this drop ceiling, as I remove hide the waveguides. Above this, there's about this much lightweight, fluffy fiberglass. Now, in the ceiling, I haven't put the HVAC in yet, which I shall do. This is just a design concept in progress here. Now, here is our hard flush system. And that drop ceiling was down to about here, as you can see the top of this.
How high is the ceiling?
So, I have to measure it. Probably 14 feet.
Okay.
Something like that. This drawing is in metric. I've become very accustomed to metric, and I love it. I wish the United States would go to metric, because the imperial system is pain in the butt.
Jimmy Carter tried.
There'll be a few more generations, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've got our systems flush mounted here. This is a concrete wall cladded with a nice finished plywood, really nice wood. And amps are embedded here and connected very directly to the speakers. I'm showing the ATC 110s and some rhythmic subs there.
You know, I was going to ask you what would be your preference for monitors, especially soffit mounted monitors. Would that be it, ATCs, or is that what the client wanted?
I love ATCs. They are so truthful.
Yeah.
And I will repeat what Tom always said is, you want the truth. That's what you want, is the truth. PMCs aren't bad, but they have that rise on the top end that I don't like. And a lot of people tend to put the toilet paper over the tweeters on those things, like you used to do on the NS10.
Yeah, yeah.
And they need to fix that. And I put subs in the back in this room.
Ah.
I've got a diffuser. Oh, this is, we got four subs in here. So it's this base management system, and it's really accurate that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
This is a very deep back wall. Very important to trap the bass. We've got this diffuser. Now, this diffuser is not, you're not going to hear this. You're not going to hear it at all. Your subconscious will.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Prime 1151. It's not a Prime 7 like most garbage is out there. The Prime 7s are for conference rooms or for LED rooms, which, you know, that doesn't work. It just doesn't. You hear it and you compensate for it with your knobs. So you won't hear this, but this will give you a sense of a back wall, because right here, as you can see, there's no bloody back wall. I mean, it goes deep, really deep.
What's the volume of the room? How deep is it, just out of curiosity?
Let's see. All right, hang on. Let me pull up my...
It looks big.
Yeah, it is. It's not that big. It's really not that big. This is the volume of the room. The volume is 185 cubic meters or 6,500 cubic feet, but that also includes a 4-foot space underneath the floor. So we take that away. The height is not 457. It's subtracted. It's probably 327 or something from the floor.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's not 15 feet high. It's more like 13 feet.
Yeah. Okay. I get it.
But it's plenty of volume.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a nice size, actually.
Yeah. It's not too big and it's not too small. As you can see, the man isn't that little in here. Now, if I take this away, and that's a grill that goes over this floor trap, that goes down about 4 feet. And this is an anechoic chamber underneath. It goes under the whole floor, and it also appears in the back. It comes up through the back, through the waveguides. This back is about 3.5-4 feet deep.
Wow. Okay, that's new to me, doing that. I don't think I've seen that before.
Well, this is done in NE rooms. It's done like this in non-environment rooms. The sides are done a lot deeper in non-environment rooms, but I found it unnecessary. So you have a point source here. This is your point. This is where the sound is coming from. It's flowing from front to back, and it's raking the sides of this treatment here, which is, it's going through a lot of this at an oblique angle. And so it goes through. It's really deep. It's deeper than you would think because of the angle of incidence. They're 12 inches deep, so that is not thin.
yeah, that's a good size there. That's why you probably couldn't do this in a room that was constructed already.
No, no, you can't.
This is from a ground up.
Correct. It's the only way to do this is ground up. This, I'm going to hide all of this, and we're going to go back to conceptual. I'll show you my basement. This is what's going on underneath. It's an anechoic chamber.
Wow.
So what this does, it traps your width mode and your length mode, which are the most crucial in the room. And then that's totally trapped because, see, if I look at top view, you can see the flow, the way it flows from the front down through and then up the back. It's like it's like the Roach Motel. They check in, but they don't check
yeah,
out.
Yeah, right. Wow. Very cool.
Here's a side view of it. This is with everything. You see the waveguides in the ceiling. There's fluffy fiberglass filled in here, not shown for clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's fiberglass around behind this angled plywood that I didn't elaborate on. And we were talking about reflections and reflectivity and keeping the high frequencies in there. On the sides, I have these angled reflective slats that are pointed to the back of the room. They deflect anything from getting to the engineer, but they keep the energy in the room a little longer. Same way with this angled plywood along the sides and walls.
How big is the shell on this? How thick are the walls and the shell?
I got 250. The 250, that's 10 inches.
And it's what?
No, this is poured concrete. This is an ideal. This is an idealized concept. Okay, so remember there's ideals and then there's reality in the real world. And you know, you'll notice all the corners, they're perfectly 90 degrees. Real world, you'll never see that.
Well, it's funny because there is a studio. My friends at Oasis Mastering up the street from where I live here, they're in an Augsburger room.
Yes.
And it was originally built for ADR. And when the post company went out of business, you know, they took it over. So one day, the owner, Eddie Schreier, took me upstairs to look down over the top to see how this thing was built. And the interesting thing is it's in the flight path of Burbank Airport.
Uh-huh.
So it has to be quiet. And it is. It's dead quiet because it's pretty much the same as what you're talking about. It's the same shell that they had. It works. It really works. It
has to be, you know. Remember Jim Carrey in Liar, Liar? He was telling the judge he had to go to the bathroom, and he was saying it could give you problems and maybe cause cancer and stuff if you held it and stuff. And he says, and the judge says, is that true? And he says, it has to be because
right.
He couldn't lie, you know. So, yeah, we have to do it like that. Until we come up with something that's tested and proven to work better, absolutely. I would really like to see something come out that's tested and works better than this because that's cheaper to build. Oh, my goodness. Yes, please.
Well, every now and then I see some things that are a paper of some experimental treatment that someone's working on that always sounds real good, but I never see the product thereafter, which kind of tells you what's, you know, where that's going on. Okay, so let's go someplace else for a second. So what was the biggest mistake you ever made?
Oh my goodness. I think angling speakers, hard flush mounted and then angling the speakers. That, let's see another. One time, this wasn't really my fault, but I didn't have the information and it was ignored and we had sound issues, soundproofing issues. So it's important. If you're working with a designer, that you tell him everything.
Yeah, sure.
You make sure you give him all the data. Anyway.
Yeah, it's funny. I worked at a brand new studio. It was in a small little industrial park here in Chatsworth, I think. It worked great until nobody understood that there was a metal worker on the other side of the complex who had a metal press. And every time this press came down, everything shook.
It will.
So they had Fleetwood Mac coming in after my session, and they stayed for a day and then left because they couldn't work. So eventually what they had to do is go to the guy and pay to float the floor under the press.
Exactly.
And
that's the cheapest way, actually. That's what I always suggest to my clients. We had a place in, where was it? Taiwan. They built, they had a studio on the 13th floor. On the second floor, there was a print shop. And they had some big presses going. And I said, the best thing to do, you need to go down there and you need to get them to install this, you know, do this. And they did, and it solved the problems. You know, if you got kids running upstairs and the thumping is getting in your studio, and that's all the problem. They don't mind hearing your music, but it's the kids thumping, running around in the living room that's a problem.
Yeah.
Get some Regupol, put down the floor, put the flooring on top of that, and impact. That's the easiest way to fix it rather than build a room in a room. Yeah. Source. Fix the source.
Yeah. Last question, John. What is the best piece of business advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or you learned along the way?
I don't know if it's business advice, but this is something I tell everyone, and I think it's very important. The first thing is don't get into debt if you can help it. But the number one thing is do what you love. Do what you love, because I mean, I was born like this. I was a little kid. I was doing this kind of thing. And it's what I've always wanted to do. So I followed that. I didn't listen to my dad when he said, music business? Oh, John, come on. You know, you need to get a real job, you know. But I followed my heart. And you know what? It's not about, you know how you get good at something? Practice. Practice. It's not talent. It's not natural. It's practice. But those that are called naturally talented or naturally good at something, naturally good at math or good at drawing or good at music, it's because that's what they love to do, and they do it all the time, and they get good at it. So if you do what you love, you'll be good at it, and you'll rise to the top of your whatever you do.
10,000 hours.
Yes, sir. Oh, my.
You can find out more about John and his designs and find some great tools and resources at jhbrandt.com. J.H. Brandt, that's J-H-B-R-A-N-D-T, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com, select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-in form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.